Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 31st of December, these are our main stories. The former boss of Renault-Nissan, Carlos Ghosn, who's been under house arrest in Japan, is reported to have arrived in Lebanon. Bolivia's interim president has ordered the expulsion of the Mexican ambassador and two Spanish diplomats, accusing them of interfering in the country's affairs. Northern India, including the capital Delhi, is experiencing one of its coldest spells in well over a century. Also in this podcast...
How sweet to be an idiot.
The musician and comedian Neil Innes, who collaborated with Monty Python, has died. Reports from Lebanon say the former Renault-Nissan boss, Carlos Ghosn, is in Beirut despite facing trial for financial wrongdoing in Japan. Unnamed sources say Mr. Ghosn arrived there by private plane on Sunday from Turkey. Mr. Ghosn has been under house arrest in Tokyo with strict conditions attached since he was first granted bail 9 months ago. He denies enriching himself at his company's expense and misstating his income. My colleague Nuala McGovern heard more from Jamie Robertson of BBC Business.
He did arrive by private jet in Lebanon. And the first question one has to ask is why Lebanon? It's rather a strange place. Well, he's generally described as being Brazilian-born, Carlos Ghosn, but obviously the chair and CEO of Nissan and also of Mitsubishi-Nissan and also of Nissan-Mitsubishi-Renault partnership. Brazilian-born. He's actually Lebanese. His parents are Lebanese. He has a number of Lebanese interests. He's actually got a share in a winery in Lebanon. So, in fact, it's not an impossible place for him to end up. Why he is there, what the arrangement has been with the Japanese government, because at the moment he's facing charges of serious financial misconduct, we simply don't know. Has a deal been done? Has he broken his bail? Because he was on bail. We don't know. That at the moment is something of a mystery.
And for people who weren't following this story closely at the time, explain his significance.
Well, he is one of the sort of great tycoons of the car industry. He came to Renault in about 1996, came from Michelin. He turned around their South African business. And then when Renault bought 40% of Nissan, he was parachuted into Nissan to turn around that company, which he did with a remarkable success. He introduced the Nissan Leaf, which, if you've heard of any electric vehicles, you've probably heard of Tesla, you've probably heard of a Nissan Leaf. Nissan Leaf is the biggest selling electric car in the world. And then he spearheaded a move to take a share in Mitsubishi as well, and that's why he has those three companies, really, underneath his, well, had, until he was charged with financial misconduct, had those companies under his wing. But then things started to go wrong round about November 2018, and he was arrested with these charges. First one being that he was underreporting his pay. Second thing, that he was misusing company assets. Those are the two things he was faced with. He was in jail for something like 109 days. And then he came out, was put on bail, but he charged the Japanese government and the regulators for a conspiracy against him. And that is basically the point at which we're at.
Jamie Robertson of BBC Business. The interim government in Bolivia says it's expelling the ambassador of Mexico and two Spanish diplomats in a growing row over their alleged interference in Bolivian affairs. The decision was announced by the interim president of Bolivia, Jeanine Áñez, over an alleged attempt by the diplomats to extract from the Mexican ambassador's residence a former aide to the ousted left-wing president Evo Morales, and she made the situation clear.
This group of representatives of the governments of Mexico and Spain has seriously injured the sovereignty of the people and the constitutional government of Bolivia. I am requesting them to leave the country within a 72-hour period.
Ms. Áñez assumed office after Evo Morales was ousted last month. He was given asylum in Mexico. Spain has announced in retaliation it will expel three Bolivian diplomats. For more on the growing diplomatic row between Bolivia and Mexico, I've been speaking to our Latin America correspondent, Will Grant.
It is a constant escalation of the bad feeling between the two nations. It started from Bolivia's point of view when Mexico offered asylum to the former president Evo Morales, who resigned at the request of the military in November. And since then, it's just been a steady sort of downward spiral of relations. First, the government of President Añez, the interim government in Bolivia, posted police outside the embassy building, the Mexican embassy building in La Paz, and the ambassador's residence. That obviously caused a protest from the Mexican side, and now we see this situation where the Mexican ambassador has been declared persona non grata, and Mexico, to sort of guarantee her safety, has called her back to Mexico City.
And what sort of reaction has there been from Mexico and from Spain?
Well, it's constantly kind of getting worse in terms of just how angry the two sides are. In Spain, they've sort of acted with a reciprocal measure by expelling three Bolivian diplomats who are accredited in Madrid. In the Mexican example, there isn't an ambassador in Mexico, a Bolivian ambassador, so it's very difficult for them to throw out any other staff. There are very, very few people on the Bolivian side in Mexico who could be thrown out. But Mexico said it plans to take charges against Bolivia in the International Court of Justice at The Hague, and obviously have accused the South American nation of violating the Vienna Convention.
And what do you think will be the key to unlocking this diplomatic impasse?
Honestly, a change of government in Bolivia. I mean, there are due to be elections sometime over the next 60 days. I don't believe have a date for that yet, but I honestly can't see the relationship improving between the Añez government and the government in Mexico of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. I think unless there's either a return to the same party of Evo Morales, which is a possibility, or if it is a conservative government still, that it isn't the one run by interim president Añez, I can't see things getting better under the current administration.
Will Grant in Mexico. India's meteorological authority has confirmed that the north of the country, including the capital Delhi, is experiencing one of its coldest spells in well over a century. Here's David Bamford.
Recent days have seen the temperature in Delhi drop to an almost unprecedented 2.5 degrees Celsius, and the mean maximum temperature for December is expected to be just a shade above 19 degrees. It's only been that low once in the last 100 years, and that was in 1973. The cold weather has brought dense fog, which, combined with city pollution, has sharply reduced visibility. This has led to hundreds of flight cancellations and disruption to rail and road traffic.
David Bamford reporting. Well, next to Australia, where scores of fires continue to burn out of control amid a heat wave that's seen temperatures exceed 40 degrees Celsius in every state. The most dangerous fires on Monday were in Victoria. Around 30,000 residents and tourists were urged to flee from East Gippsland, a popular holiday region, but evacuations were later deemed too risky as fires encroached on major roads. From Sydney, here's Shaima Halil.
Scorching temperatures, strong winds and thunderstorms created dangerous conditions throughout the day in Victoria. More than 10 emergency fire warnings have been issued. One of them is north of the city of Melbourne. The East Gippsland region has seen the worst fire activity. At least three blazes have rapidly expanded as temperatures soared to the mid-40s. Officials said the wind-driven blazes were racing towards the coast and had moved faster than predicted. The East Coast region is a popular tourist destination. A British woman, Lucy Morris-Marr, was in the area for a family vacation and kept getting texts telling her to leave while sitting on the beach.
Everything seemed calm, it didn't seem urgent, and all the locals and the hoteliers and the shopkeepers just was business as usual. So for some time we were thinking, well, what should we do? And everyone's on holiday. It was the equivalent, really, of asking Cornwall to leave on bank holiday in August.
In New South Wales, a volunteer firefighter died battling a blaze, and two others were taken to hospital with burns. More than 100 fires are continuing to burn across the country. The biggest are raging near Sydney. The New Year's Eve fireworks in the city have run into controversy. More than 250,000 people have signed a petition calling for them to be cancelled, but the authorities have confirmed they are going ahead as planned.
Shaima Halil in Australia. Now to Russia, where Moscow won't let warmer temperatures get in the way of a beautiful dusting of snow. Authorities in the capital have dumped artificial snow in the city centre for New Year's Eve festivities after the country experienced its warmest year on record. It's a far cry from the so-called general winter, the famous sub-zero temperatures that helped to defeat Napoleon and Hitler. James Kumarasamy got the latest snow report, either real or artificial, from the BBC's Steve Rosenberg in Moscow.
I was so excited today to see the snowflakes coming down that I just jumped out of my living room, and I'm speaking to you from the snow outside in Moscow. It's an incredible sight. Now, normally, of course, we'd be used to lots of snow. Normally, at this time of year, I'd spend 10 minutes digging the car out of the snowdrifts, and there'd be an army of snow clearers and snow ploughs on the Moscow streets clearing away all this stuff and trying to get rid of it. But this year, this has been one of the warmest Decembers on record in Moscow. There's been hardly a flake. So it's very exciting, finally, just before the New Year celebration, to see some snow.
And, of course, there was some fake snow brought in for the occasion, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. The Moscow authorities brought in some fake snow to the centre of the city a couple of days ago. This was to make a snowboarding hill in the centre. Lots of reaction on social media to that. Lots of jokes about the fake snow. But now we've got some real stuff. I hope it lasts. But the weather forecast isn't great for the next few days. At the moment it's -1. It's going to creep above zero again, so the snow might melt.
And of course, for the uninitiated, you said -1. Normally at this time of year, you don't need to put the minus in front, do you? When you're talking about temperatures in Russia, you just talk about 10 or 8 and everyone knows it's minus.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes the temperatures creep above zero, but not for long. Normally in a Russian winter and a Moscow winter, it's minus all the way. I remember one winter, it went down to -33°C. And that is very cold. I mean, you could hardly open your mouth. This is almost tropical, the weather. I mean, -1. And at one point earlier this month, the temperature went up to +6, which is almost Caribbean, really, for Russia.
And what are Muscovites making of it?
A mixed reaction, actually. Some people I've spoken to have said it's quite nice. Makes a nice change, actually, that they don't have to put on their warmest, thickest coats. And they don't have to spend lots of time digging out the car. Other people have said, well, this just isn't Russia, is it? This is not the festive landscape that they want to see. And, of course, there is concern about global warming. We know that, you know, up in the polar region of Russia, the ice is melting there. There is concern about that. But I think closer to home, you know, we have the big New Year celebration coming up, which is the biggest night of the year. Muscovites are used to celebrating that with snow. You know, the snow's on their New Year cards, the snow's mentioned in the New Year songs, when they watch their New Year TV programmes, the snow, and they want to see it, the real snow. At the moment we've got some, as I say, it's scrunching under my feet as I'm moving along. I just hope it stays here for a few more days.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Now, as we heard in our earlier podcast, the father of the Swedish climate change activist Greta Thunberg says her campaign has helped her to beat severe depression. Svante Thunberg said he initially thought the climate campaign was a bad idea for his 16-year-old daughter who has Asperger's syndrome, but in reality it's helped her to enjoy life again. The issue of climate has again been in the news throughout the year. To see the impact of climate change most clearly, you have to head to the ends of the Earth, the two poles. The BBC has been to both during the year. Our science editor Tom Fielden now reports on the state of play in Antarctica.
From the top of the ramp, the finger of glacial ice that towers over the Rothera Research Station, it's easy to be lulled into a false sense of security. It's high summer here now on the Antarctic Peninsula, but still the ice beneath my feet is hundreds of metres thick. But appearances can be deceptive. Away to the south, there's open water, and although I can't feel it, the glacier I'm standing on is running down to the sea faster than ever. Across the continent, scientists are documenting similar changes. The slumbering white giant at the bottom of the world is waking up.
So, the drilling. So we are going to go through the ice sheet into the underlying bedrock.
1,000 miles away, one of those scientists, the Cambridge geologist Dr. Joanna Johnson, surveys the frozen glacier that'll be her home over the next few months.
That will tell us that the site has been ice-free at some time in the past few thousand years.
Dr. Johnson's one of the lead investigators on the Thwaites Collaboration, an international research programme studying one of the major glaciers that make up the West Antarctic ice sheet. About the size of Great Britain, Thwaites has recently begun to accelerate, flowing into the Amundsen Sea at an unprecedented rate.
We're quite concerned about the future of Thwaites because the rate of flow of the glacier has increased hugely in the past 30 years or so. And at the moment, it's contributing about 4% of global sea level rise. And I think the concern is that this is going to increase potentially quite rapidly.
Unlike the Arctic, and in particular the Greenland ice sheet, which is melting 7 times faster than in the 1990s, Antarctica had been thought to be relatively stable, with greater snowfall roughly compensating for increased melting. But the most recent satellite data shows that broad equilibrium is breaking down. Where Greenland leads, Professor Andy Shepherd, who heads the IMBY consortium of satellite modellers, argues Antarctica is set to follow.
It's really, really clear now. In the past decade alone, Antarctica and Greenland ice losses have increased by huge factors. In Antarctica by a factor 5, Greenland by a factor 7 over what they were in the 1990s. And that is the glaciers starting to wake up and to flow more quickly into the sea.
This is one of our gliders. This one's called Bella.
Driving and that accelerating flow into the sea is warmer water. Yellow. Antarctica's ice sheets are melting from beneath.
I always say that they're like mechanical dolphins.
But exactly how much and how quickly, because the damage is hidden under thousands of square miles of ice, is hard to quantify.
Some gadgets on the top.
Gadgets, exactly.
The University of East Anglia's Professor Karen Haywood is using an array of autonomous gliders and robotic submarines, including Autosub Long Range, better known as Boaty McBoatface, to quantify the losses.
So what Boaty McBoatface can tell us is what is it like underneath that ice shelf, how turbulent it is, how much is the ice melting, how much of that warm water is getting underneath the ice shelf.
Alison, hi. Good to see you. You've just got back.
Yes, we got back yesterday afternoon.
Back on the surface of the ice, another process already well established in the Arctic and on the Greenland ice sheet is beginning to appear in Antarctica.
So we've been out installing various instruments.
Dr. Alison Banwell has spent the last 2 months camped out on the George VI ice shelf studying the formation of meltwater lakes on the surface of the ice.
You may have heard of the breakup of the Larsen B ice shelf, which happened in 2002. Before the ice shelf broke up, over 2,000 lakes were observed to drain in the couple of weeks before the breakup. And we've been running models and looking at satellite images, which show that those lakes may have caused the breakup to occur.
Scientists had thought Antarctica was simply too big, too cold for meltwater lakes to have much of an impact. But again, it seems where the Arctic leads, Antarctica may be destined to follow.
Tom Fielden in Antarctica. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service celebrating the best of its editions in 2019. Here's Jackie.
A world of wonder.
60 seconds. That's just crazy to try to do something as dangerous as that around the moon.
Moments of joy.
What you should see now is a cloud.
No way.
A world of drama.
We don't have to be afraid now. Look at us.
And real life too.
This is maybe the first leap of evidence we have in almost 48 years.
Amazing stories.
They hugged me and they started crying. They squeezed me and they were crying.
From all over our sphere.
There's nothing that you can't do in this world if you set your mind to it.
Shall we do it all again? Next year. Podcasts from the BBC World Service. Search for BBC World Service wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks, Jackie. The Turkish government has sent a bill to Parliament that will allow it to deploy troops in Libya as the conflict there intensifies. It'll be debated on Thursday, though it's not clear when a vote will happen. Putting the law before Parliament marks an acceleration of President Erdogan's plans. Turkey is allied with Libya's UN-backed government, which is based in the capital Tripoli. It's under growing pressure from the forces of the warlord General Khalifa Haftar, which are trying to capture the city. The general is backed by Egypt, the UAE and others. The Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu explained Turkey's stance on the Libyan issue.
The decision is up to political parties. This is a national issue. We would like to act together with all political parties on issues concerning our national security.
So, are there more reasons why Turkey's so keen to want to send its soldiers to Libya? James Kumarasamy spoke to Sona Chaptagai from the Washington Institute, the author of Erdogan's Empire, Turkey and the Politics of the Middle East.
For a while now, Turkey's old adversaries, Greece and Cyprus, and new adversaries, Egypt and Israel, have been forming, as Ankara sees it, a bloc that boxes Turkey in the Eastern Mediterranean. That means Turkey sees its maritime contact with Libya as the only way with which it can pierce through this quote-unquote anti-Turkish axis, hence Ankara's fierce interest in making sure that the government in Tripoli wins Libya's civil war and therefore undermine this anti-Turkish axis in the Eastern Med as Ankara sees it.
So if this bill is passed, does that automatically mean that Turkey will deploy troops to Libya, you think?
I think that that will be certain at that stage. Turkish President Erdogan, though he's a divisive figure domestically, has over and again managed to align his foreign policy initiatives with the broader public sentiments. He's done this in Syria. He's now trying to do it in Libya. Of course, in Libya, Erdogan is fighting a proxy war against United Arab Emirates and Egypt, who are supporting militias of Haftar in Libya's eastern-based government. But on top of it, Erdogan is speaking out the Turkish public sentiments that Turkey should not be boxed in by its oldest adversary, Greece, in the Mediterranean. So I think he will have quite broad, not universal, but quite broad public support for deployment overseas once this bill passes through the Turkish parliament.
You mentioned the regional powers, but of course there are other powers with interests in Libya, and countries such as Russia has of course taken the side of General Haftar. Does that not give President Erdogan pause for thought?
Yeah, it should be cause for concern, but remember what happened in Syria. Turkey and Russia were at opposing ends. Turkey supporting the rebels, Russia backing the Assad regime. And yet, fast forward, in recent years, they have started to broker ad hoc deals. In the absence of U.S. initiatives in Libya, and with the dwindling European commitment to that country's territorial integrity, I think that the country is now left open for Turkish-Russian competition, which also could mean Turkish-Russian compromise at the end of the day.
Sona Chaptagai from the Washington Institute. A rows erupted in the UK after two leading private schools rejected an offer of just under $1 million to help disadvantaged pupils. The pupils are poor white boys. The schools say the gift wouldn't be compatible with their values. The findings were made in the British cultural and political magazine Standpoint. For more on the background to this, here's Alison Davis.
Well, here in the UK, the vast majority of pupils, some 93%, attend state, that's government-funded schools. Just 7% are educated in the independent sector, private schools, usually paid for by parents, with fees of thousands of dollars. And just 7%, and yet they end up by playing a disproportionate role of the country's top jobs.
And that's in politics, in medicine, in the law, those kind of professions.
It is indeed. And now, philanthropists like the rap star Stormzy, have been trying to redress the balance. Stormzy himself has established scholarships at Cambridge University. That's awards for black British students.
But actually in the UK, it's poor white boys who tend to be the worst performers in schools.
Yes, surveys show that they are the worst performers in exams. So enter 96-year-old Sir Brian Thwaites, himself a former scholarship boy, who decided to leave just under $1 million in his will to two leading private schools, specifically to help those white working-class boys. an offer you would think, Andrew, the schools couldn't refuse.
But actually they have refused it. They've turned it down.
They turned the offer down. Winchester and Dulwich College rejected the money for fear of breaching anti-discrimination laws. The decision triggered this reaction from listeners to the BBC.
I was always inspired as a young man by Martin Luther King, who said we shouldn't be judged by the colour of our skin, but the content of our character.
Even if you're a white working class boy, you're still in an overwhelmingly white country and you're probably not going to suffer that race penalty.
So, Alison, what does the law have to say about this?
Well, this is where it gets slightly complicated. Positive discrimination, where an individual is given preferential treatment because of a specific characteristic, is generally illegal in Britain. But education providers are allowed to take what's called positive action to remedy a disadvantage faced by particular groups of students. Trevor Phillips helped frame the equality legislation.
We did not call it the Be Kind to Brown People Act because we wanted to make sure there would not be discrimination against people on the grounds of race or gender or sexual orientation. And secondly, that there would be opportunities for institutions or individuals to support those who, because of their race or gender, were at a disadvantage.
And Alison, what are the schools saying about it?
Winchester College has said it couldn't see how discrimination on the grounds of a boy's colour could ever be compatible with its values. And Dulwich College has said it opposes awards being made using ethnic or religious criteria. As for Sir Brian, he's now revealed that a state school has accepted his offer of money and he plans to talk to other state schools.
Alison Davis reporting. This week on The World Service, the BBC's specialist reporters are giving their take on what to expect in 2020 in various different fields, from health, the environment and technology. Today we look at the world of sport with our correspondent Alex Capstick.
In the beginning, it was described as a zany idea, but a continent-wide Euros will happen. The man who inspired it, the former UEFA boss Michel Platini, is no longer around, having been found guilty of corruption. But his unprecedented and ambitious plan for a tournament spread across 12 nations is set in stone. Attempts to mitigate logistical problems for fans wanting to follow their teams have made things a little easier, but it's going to be difficult to replicate the atmosphere created when a single country hosts a major event. That shouldn't be a problem for the Olympics.
The International Olympic Committee has the honour of announcing that the Games of the 32nd Olympiad in 2020 are awarded to the city of Tokyo. Yeah!
And tickets for the Games have been selling like hotcakes, although heat is a major concern. Roasting temperatures in Japan during July and August persuaded the IOC to switch the marathon to the north of the country, where the climate is cooler. It upset the local organisers, who preferred to make the event as compact as possible. Should be lots of highlights, but do look out for those sports making their Olympic debuts. They include surfing, skateboarding and climbing, all expected to pull in a much-needed younger audience. But there are fears this could become the fourth successive Olympics to have its build-up scarred by the Russian doping scandal.
The consequences include the banning of Russia from the Olympics, Paralympics and World Championships run by all code signatories for 4 years.
Russia has appealed against sanctions which have banned its flag and anthem while forcing its athletes to compete under a neutral banner. We're now waiting for a final decision from the Court of Arbitration for Sport. And while we're on the subject of legal action, the Swiss courts still haven't ruled on whether World Athletics has violated Casta Semenya's human rights by ordering her to lower natural levels of testosterone if she wants to defend her 800 metres title in Tokyo, something she's refused to comply with. 2019 saw the Cricket World Cup, the World Test Championship got underway, and next we have the T20 World Cup. Confused? Well, you're not alone. For those non-experts, T20 is a fast, action-packed, popular version of the game. The Whizbang Fest takes place over October and November in Australia, but it's no longer the shortest version. That accolade belongs to something called the 100. I only have time to tell you it's a bit different, it's aimed at families and will take up 4 weeks of the English summer. And finally, let me mark your card with a heavyweight boxing blockbuster. The rematch between Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury is in February. The first fight, which ended in a draw, was an epic contest, and that's why there's so much interest in the follow-up.
Alex Capstick. The British musician and comedian Neil Innes, who collaborated with the comedy group Monty Python in the 1970s, has died at the age of 75. A founding member of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, he went on to form the Beatles pastiche group The Ruttles, in which he played the character Ron Nasty, based on John Lennon. Our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones looks back at his career.
Neil Innes began his musical career with the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, a group of students making surreal jazz-inspired songs like this one. I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I've got speed. It was a big hit in 1968, co-produced by Paul McCartney. After the band split up, Neil Innes began working with Monty Python. We'll dance to the round table, we dance. He became known as the Seventh Python, thanks to his contributions to the group's sketches and films, including The Holy Grail.
I don't know if you noticed that every time a heavy object was catapulted out of a castle, like a giant wooden rabbit or a cow, it fell on me.
In 1976, Neil Innes joined Eric Idle on the series Rutland Weekend Television. I feel good. The show spawned The Ruttles, a parody of the Beatles. Ironically, his own music was imitated too. How sweet to be an idiot. Noel Gallagher borrowed this tune for the Oasis track Whatever. Despite his celebrity connections, Neil Innes didn't seek the limelight. I'm lucky, he once said. I've leant against doors and they've opened.
Rebecca Jones on the life of the British musician and comedian Neil Innes, who's died at the age of 75. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast and the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
When you're not opening presents this holiday season, try smashing your way through some tricky chocolate-coated levels on Candy Crush Saga. In between dinner and dessert, switch and match. During one of Uncle Mike's long stories, master the candy. There are thousands of levels to play in the all-time favorite classic Match 3 game. Get that sweet feeling this holiday with Candy Crush Saga. Download it now from the App Store or Google Play for free.